is made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Good afternoon. Before we talk with Jack Brighton, our Director of Internet Operations in Pledge Central, I want to bring a news story to your attention. Several people are reportedly injured in the partial collapse of a building in Mattoon today. Reports from the Central Illinois town say a demolition crew was working on a building in an older section of downtown when part of it gave way late this morning. Nearby businesses have been evacuated and the street remains blocked off. The coroner has been called in, but no fatalities have been confirmed. Injured people could be seen being taken from the site on stretchers. City officials have called a news conference for later this afternoon. AM 580 News reporter Jim Meadows is on his way, repeating several people reportedly injured in the partial collapse of a building in Mattoon today. We'll keep you up to date on this breaking news story here on AM 580. Now let's talk with Jack Brighton in Pledge Central. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Celeste.
How are you?
We're doing great. Actually, I'm feeling really good because Jay Pierce just brought me up to date on the total of the pledge drive so far this week. We've so far raised $126,000 and a little bit more, and that's really tremendous. 358 new members have joined the Friends of WILL, which we're asking you to keep adding to by calling 217-244-9455 with your pledge call. That's the good news. The bad news is that we still have a goal today of $140,000, so we still need to raise another $13,000 or so by the end of the day. That's some heavy lifting, but it's very light work with many hands. So
that's right.
If you will please go to your telephone right now, this is the last chance this week, actually not right this moment, but today is the last day of our weekday fund drive. Thank you. I've been talking a lot this week, you can tell. And so if you're a fan of the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn, all the news and information and interviews, the weather, etc., that you get on this station, please give us a call with your support. It's very quick and easy to do. 217-244-9455 to make a pledge.
We're in the final hours of our spring membership drive, our spring fund drive, and by the end of this drive, we hope to have reached that $160,000 mark. And so today, we're hoping, in order to stay on track, that we hit $140,000 before the end of the day. If you've not yet made a financial commitment to this public radio station, please do so today. Become a member of the Friends of WILL, 217-244-9455. Basic membership, $40 a year. The area code 217, the number 244-9455. And to everyone who has joined us this week, to our new friends and to our returning friends, thank you very much. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. More than three decades after enactment of Title IX, how are high school girls faring in math, science, and technology courses? That's one of the questions we take up in this portion of the program. Our guest today is David Sadker, a professor of education at American University. He and his late wife, Myra Sadker, gained a national reputation for confronting gender bias and sexual harassment. Together, they authored groundbreaking books on gender in the classroom, including Failing at Fairness, How American Schools Cheat Girls. Professor Sadker's research and writing document sex bias from the classroom to the boardroom, and his work has received many awards, including an award from the American Association of Colleges for Teacher Education for pioneering work in gender equity. Professor Sadker is visiting the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He was the keynote speaker today for the university's conference on gender in the pre-college science, mathematics, and technology. Area educators as well as future teachers are attending this symposium at the U of I. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call. The number's in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Professor Sadker, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, the question I posed at the outset, let's talk about that. How are high school girls faring in math, science, and technology courses?
Those are actually three different questions because they vary.
Okay.
Basically, the progress for females over the past 30 years has been both remarkable and uneven. Some areas, for example, undergraduate biology, undergraduate chemistry, and math, they've done amazingly well. I could think back to the 1970s when people said genetics or brain differences or hormones would keep girls from doing well. And the change, the test scores have gone up quicker than the gene can travel. I mean, it's been amazing. On the other hand, there are persistent barriers. Physics is a barrier. Engineering is a barrier. Still, 85% of our engineers are males 30 years after Title IX. And when you get to the master's or doctoral level, you realize that we have glass all around girls. We have glass ceilings for graduate degrees. We have glass walls. By the way, this also impacts males as well. Let me give you an example. Engineering is 85% and constant for males in terms of who's becoming an engineer. In terms of elementary teachers, when I was in school, it was 75% female. Now it's 85% female. Computer science 10 years ago was 65% male. Now it's 75% male. So certain areas are becoming hyper-segregated, and that's an area of concern.
Okay, so it seems that that gender gap in math and science has shrunk a little, but with the exception of physics, let's say, and
engineering and the advanced degrees.
Okay.
Right.
But in regard to technology, it sounds like it's growing.
Correct. Sad. And then when I talk about Title IX, and we might want to mention that Title IX is really under attack now, and its 30th anniversary. Now we're dealing with our second proposal to cut back protections of Title IX. So that law is in serious danger. But in terms of some areas, let me give you an area where we think females have done well. We think they've done well in law and medicine. When I was young, and I hate using myself as a history example, but I am. Females, you know, 5% of medical schools, 10% of law school. Now they're almost half of those schools. I mean, it's amazing. But if you look into those careers, they're ghettoized. So in medicine, they tend to be pediatricians or OBGYN or general practice or psychiatry, the lowest paying areas of medicine. The same thing in law. They tend to be not full partners in firms making all these lots of dollars, but they tend to be in government or social work or causes to help people improve. On the value side, I'm pleased they're there because they're really fighting the important battle. On the financial side, they're being shortchanged. The income gap in medicine and law between males and females is actually greater than it is outside of those fields. Male doctors do far better than female doctors, and male lawyers far better than female lawyers. So every time we make some progress, we have to look back and see between the lines where we're not making progress. Mm.
It also sounds like we could be seeing a ghettoization of men, or that's always been there, hasn't it? I mean, in terms of what we encourage our sons and our brothers to do.
Absolutely. I'm a teacher educator. I want more men in elementary teaching, desperately. men have gone into nursing. It's been slower, but they are going into nursing, and they get rewarded in nursing. They get promoted quite quickly in the nursing field. And speaking as a father, I think too many men are taught that you earn money and that's your role in the family. You bring home the bacon and that's what you do. And I have to tell you, I teach, I write books, I'm a dad. The best thing I've ever done in my life is being a dad, by far. And to shortchange boys on the great wonders of being a dad is sad. And does them a disservice.
Yeah. Well, I can use myself as a history example as well. When I was in school, it was in the 1970s, and these attitudes were being challenged. And we saw some students crossing over those boundaries. We saw boys joining us in the home ec classes, and we saw girls move into some of the fields like mechanical engineering and that right. kind of thing, those kind of preparatory courses for either a vocation or for going on to college. And I wonder what the situation is today. Are there boys today in parenting classes?
Not many, that's for sure. And that's sad. One of the changes, I mentioned this earlier, being proposed on Title IX, is to allow public schools to create single-sex schools and classes for any reason they put forward, and they need not be equal. It is entirely possible that we may find science classes where the equipment's better and there are boys, and home ec classes where there are far more females, and we may find ourselves going back to the time when you and I went to school when that was the norm. And that's one of the dangers right now in Title IX.
Well, what do you think of single-gender classrooms and single-gender schools? Are they ever appropriate?
First of all, single-sex schools in the private sector, especially for girls, have done a wonderful job on the whole, and I really have to give them credit. They provide an education for girls that they often don't receive in co-ed. Girls in private schools talk more in class. They read a curriculum that has them in the pages. They are more likely to major in math and science, more likely to go on to college, more likely to go on to graduate school. There's just a lot of positive stuff. For males, it's less positive. The evidence isn't there. I mean, there are some wonderful all-boys schools, but the evidence that boys do better there than in co-ed is not so clear. The bottom line is, why are they doing better in single-sex schools? Some people say, well, we ought to make all schools single-sex. I don't think that's the answer. They're doing better in single-sex because they have committed parents, they have committed teachers, they have smaller classes, they're not being interrupted by boys, they find themselves in the curriculum, their academic goals are being enhanced. Guess what? Public schools could do that. My question isn't how quickly can we abandon co-ed schools. My question is, why aren't co-ed schools safe places for boys and girls to learn?
Hmm. Well, a couple of minutes ago you talked about, you know, we all have heard the term glass ceiling, but you use the term glass wall. And, you know, the thing about glass is that you can run smack dab into it because, you know, it you can see through it. Give us some sense of what that glass is in the walls that is keeping us from providing boys and girls in the same classroom, in the same building, what they need, what they deserve.
Well, I think we need to look at teacher training. I mean, let me point my finger at me and my colleagues first. That's the easiest one. Even though Myra and I did a lot of work on how teachers teach boys and girls differently, I'll give you the short report card on that. Boys get more attention in class. They're praised more. They're helped more. They're criticized more. Boys and girls often segregate themselves in class. The teacher focuses more on boys. Boys get put in the spotlight. That's not always great for boys either, but girls get left in the shadow. We still are not training teachers to deal with these issues. We still have 8 out of 10 students reporting that they receive sexual harassment comments or touches in school. And by the way, for boys, it's almost as high. It's 76%. So both boys and girls are not always safe in school. Teachers are not always having them work together. And I think we can do a better job in teacher training.
So it sounds like we've got some things here that are subtle and some that are very overt.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we have evidence of all of this. For example, if I asked you who is getting a higher report card, who do you think gets higher report cards, boys or girls?
The girls.
Yeah. If I asked you who do you think gets higher test scores on like the SAT or the MCATs or the LSATs for law school or medical school, who do you think?
I don't know. I would say it's a toss-up, but I don't. You're giving me a look like
tilt. It's not surprising you don't know, because girls get better report cards. People often don't look at the tests. Boys outscore girls on the math SAT by about 40 points, on the verbal SAP by about 6 points. They've outscored girls for a long, long time. As a matter of fact, they are now rewriting the SATs again to try to do something about that. Boys outperform girls on the MCATs for medical school, the GMATs for business school, the LSATs for law school, and on the GREs, which you need for master's or doctorate, the gap has been for almost three decades 120 points of male advantage. So the question I think every educator and every parent in America has to ask themselves is, why is one gender getting better grades and the other gender getting better test scores? It amazes me that people don't even ask the question.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are voices out there raised, you know, in concern that it's our boys who are in trouble, that boys are falling behind, that the boys aren't getting good grades, the girls are.
Yeah, you're taking me back to my personal history lesson, aren't you?
Yeah.
Absolutely. People don't realize the first books written about sexism in school, they were all about boys. Teddy Roosevelt complained about what was happening to boys. Boys are being feminized by female teachers. Why Johnny can't read. It was all placed on teachers and on the boy problem. What was amazing when Myra wrote, actually my late wife wrote the first book about sexism in schools in 1973, is that people said, what problem do girls have? They don't get into trouble. They get good grades. And the fact that they didn't feel good about themselves, they didn't go on to careers, they were second-class citizens, that wasn't even raised. Now we're raising that. And so some people say, oh, but it's really boys who have a problem. This is a no-win argument. It's destructive. Parents of daughters and parents of sons both deserve to have schools respond appropriately to their kids. And both males and females have sex stereotypes surrounding them. We need to do better. And I mean, boys are disciplined more. They're left back more. They don't write as well. They don't read as well. They're in special ed at higher numbers. It's not an either or. There are ways of handling both these problems. And that's what we have to focus on, positive, constructive things, not deciding which group is going to get our attention.
Yeah. Looking into a classroom, when you and your late wife started working in this area, you know, it's so hard. It's like that glass wall again. It's so hard to stand back and look at the status quo. It's the status quo. That's the way we've done it. That's the way it's done. I don't see the problem. How did you guys, where did you begin?
Okay, I'll tell you two stories, personal and then how we train teachers. And I get this all. When I tell people I've been in gender issues for 35 years, they look at me, I mean, how'd that happen? And I tell them it's not because I'm particularly sensitive or intuitive or it's because I married into it. My wife and I were both doctoral students at the same time. Now, think about that today. That's rare. Years ago, that was very rare. We would go to class together. I would raise my hand. I would get called on. She would be more hesitant to raise her hand, less likely to be called on. We then would write co-author articles together and proposals together. And do you know how people would refer to our co-authored work?
David Sadker's work.
Yes. What a great article David wrote. For reasons I've never fully understood, this bothered Myra. So she wrote an editorial called The Only Socially Acceptable Form of Discrimination in the school paper, local little paper. And she talked about how it felt to be female and invisible in a doctoral program. And an editor happened to read it and said, "Do you want to write a book on it?" That's how it came to light. And that's how subtle the sexism. When people say, "I don't see the sexism, there is no sexism," I understand that because it's difficult to see. The anthropologist Margaret Mead once said, if fish were anthropologists, the last thing they would notice would be water. Mm-hmm. And the last thing we notice are all the little sexist clues around us. So when I train teachers, what I do is I show them a tape of a teacher teaching a class. I ask them to rate the teacher. Is that teacher fair? Is there some bias? Or is there significant bias? Well, the truth is most people go for some bias because they know it's a setup. You know, they're not going to say fair. But they don't see much of anything. Then I teach them how to code, how to look at the teacher and count how many times the boys are involved, how many times the girls are involved, and what the teacher says. And after 20 minutes of training, I show the tape again. They code. Guess what? The boys got 2.5 times as many questions, 4 times as many praise. It goes on and on. That's what it takes to see the sexism. You have to get an objective instrument or you'll miss it.
Mm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Excuse me. And our guest this afternoon is Professor David Sadker. He's a professor of education at American University. He and his late wife, Myra, gained a national reputation for confronting gender bias and sexual harassment. Together, they authored groundbreaking books on gender in the classroom, including Failing at Fairness, How American Schools Cheat Girls. Listeners, you can join the discussion. I welcome your questions and comments for our guest this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And we have a listener who's joining us this afternoon. The phone's ringing, I know. I can see the light flashing here. So before I launch into another question, let me just stretch a little here and tell folks that our guest this afternoon, David Sadker, is visiting the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He was a keynote speaker today for a seminar here at the University of Illinois that area educators as well as future teachers are attending, a symposium on gender in the pre-college classrooms of science, mathematics, and technology. Well, now let's go and talk with this listener, and we have a caller on line one, a cell phone. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Professor, I'm encouraged, actually, in a weird kind of a way, to hear some of the things that you're saying, and I'll tell you why. I have two boys. I have a boy right now who is 8.5. He's in the second grade. Both of my boys have Asperger's syndrome, and I'm interested to hear what you say that boys tend to get special education help more, and I know that, I don't know what the statistic is, but I know that the cases of autism and milder.
I think we lost the listener. That's a problem, I think, with the cell phone still today. But I think maybe you might be able to say something based on what we heard to the point where she dropped off.
Right. Special education is dominated by males, and there are a couple of reasons people give for that. It's not always clear why that is the case, but I think the listener was talking about autism and some of the issues. I'm not sure the stats in autism. In reading, males are 4 times as likely to be getting help. And in emotional disturbance areas, it's 10 times as likely. There are several reasons for this. One is they may be having more problems and getting that help, which is something they should get. Another is Females are better at hiding issues. They don't act out. They act in. If a male is frustrated, he becomes a behavior problem in class. If a female is frustrated, she becomes quiet in class. So we may be underdiagnosing females, in fact. I think special ed has become an enormously huge budget item. And the federal government, while mandating coverage and treatment and educational rights for these students, an appropriate thing for the federal government to be doing, it's not funding it to the level it should. And so the states are caught in the crunch. And what happens is sometimes students who aren't in special ed are caught in the crunch because the budget moves away from them. And I love people who say things like, we're spending so much more money on schools, but the test scores are not going up. You know, two responses. One, education is not only measured by test scores. Number two, the vast majority of those increases are going to special needs students, not to the regular classrooms.
Hmm. Who's in gifted programs?
That starts out being fairly even, and then it does get some stereotyping in high school. So you do have more females in the writing stuff and more males in the math and science stuff. But girls sometimes, there's some self-selection, and girls sometimes self-select out. One study showed that girls in gifted programs average a higher IQ than boys in gifted programs. Again, because they're quiet. They have to really be outstanding to be identified. There was an interesting study that I talked about this morning in the keynote that was done at the University of Illinois. It's called the Valedictorian Study. It was done in 1980, and it's a classic study. And it came out in a book a few years back called Lives of Promise, where they tracked the valedictorians, kind of gifted kids, in 81 Illinois schools throughout the state, Chicago, downstate, all around. They tracked them through college and then through work. As girls who were valedictorian went through college, when they began, one out of four thought they were very bright, rated themselves as very bright. By the time they graduated, not a single female valedictorian still rated herself as very bright. The males started out at about 1 in 4 and ended up 1 in 4. So something happens as girls and women are getting messages that being very bright, that being labeled that way may not be good. And then they make decisions on that. I want to have kids. Should I pick a career? For example, in medicine, should I pick surgery with a long residency that takes me through the childbearing age or not? And so I think women are always compromising. And the valedictorian study suggested that even among the best and the brightest, there are these compromises being made.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller on line one in Urbana. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering if, in addition to the comparison of the male to the female, can you broaden things by looking within a single gender and say, you know, a certain percentage of boys will succeed and score high on tests, but some of them will not. And does their failure, is the reasons for their failure somehow related to the reasons why the women and the girls aren't scoring so high as well? Is there a comparison that can something be learned from that kind of a comparison?
Interesting question. Boys are more likely to be at the top and the bottom. In other words, you have more boys who are scoring high on IQs and more boys who are in special needs. So they're more extreme than the girls. A lot of it is the way we organize classes, I believe. And I think girls and boys aren't succeeding for different reasons, but the same reason is we could organize classrooms differently. If they were less competitive, if we had boys, for example, more active during the learning process, I think more boys would succeed. If we had classrooms more cooperative and less competitive, I think more girls would succeed. The testing movement that we have now with No Child Left Behind, I think is not healthy for either boys and girls. In Texas, for example, when they looked at a similar testing program, they found you know, the test scores went up, and that was used to promote the national No Child Left Behind. But when they look closely at Houston, where actually the Secretary of Education, Ron Page, was a superintendent, although Houston reported 2% dropout rate, a year ago, under an audit, it was determined the dropout rate may in fact be much closer to 40%. So the reason the test scores were going up was because students were dropping out and not taking the tests, and that's a loss. So I think the test scores may be driving boys out of school as well. The short answer, and that wasn't, is to reorganize classes, be more creative in what we do, and respond to the needs of both girls and boys.
Yeah, you know, using myself as a history example, when I was in junior high especially, I did well, but the culture that I was in discouraged academic achievement. So I found myself hiding my test scores and my assignments and everything because the culture at large viewed doing well in school as a badge of shame or something. And that was just my personal experience growing up in a pretty blue-collar town. And that's the other question I had was, can we break it down by class and bring that perspective into it, and how does different classes of society change the dynamic, you know, between genders or within a gender?
I mean, you're teasing out all the key issues. Ethnicity, family background, class, they're critical. We in America love to be class blind. I don't know what it is with us, but everybody thinks they're middle class. They're making 7,000, they're making 7 million, they're all middle class. We're not all middle class. There are people who are poor, and they need special supports, and we don't do that enough. So I think you're right, and there are ethnic groups that don't value education, and that's an issue where the school and the community clash. I think especially of Hispanics who are doing, you know, some people think, quote, minority, and they lump African-Americans and Hispanics. And that's bizarre. African-Americans and Hispanics have different cultures, different needs, and Hispanics are actually doing worse in school in terms of graduation rates. So, and a lot of that is cultural. So you raise great issues.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Several years ago, I was a reporter, and I had an assignment to go and spend some time in a high school environment, you know, going back as a grown-up. And I couldn't get over how inequitable the situation was based on class in, you know, the high school there, it's right there. You know, some kids have cars and some kids have to stay on campus and have the government-supported lunch program. And the way the kids who are in the cars and who are going off to lunch and their social circle, that's viewed differently by the adults in the building.
Yeah. Let's talk about affirmative action for a second, because you're talking about middle class and lower class differences. What about higher class, upper class? People don't realize that's the most affirmative action class going. Who you know, legacies in schools. I know that if your father went to Harvard, you can get 200 points lower on the SATs, a lower grade point average in school, and you can go because you are legacy. You had a relative who went. This sounds more like the royal system in Great Britain than a democracy. And President Bush, by the way, who spoke out against affirmative action, I don't believe sees that connection at all. He went to a high school, got a C average, he got 1,200 on the SATs, and he got into Yale. I don't know anybody who gets a C average and gets into Yale, and then speaks out against affirmative action because he doesn't see that entitlement as affirmative action. I think as a nation, we have to realize that class plays a big role.
Mm. You know, education gets a lot of ink. You mentioned the president and affirmative action. It's a political Education is really a very charged political issue. And in terms of education getting a lot of ink, I think that's as it should be. But I'm wondering, how do you see the coverage education gets? Is it how, in terms of, you know, is it quality reporting? And the other question that goes hand in glove with that is, could we be smarter consumers about news about education?
Yeah, absolutely. That's an interesting question coming from a reporter. And present company accepted, of course. I think the coverage is a disaster. It is so horrid. For example, test scores. I don't know about your community, but where I come from, schools get rated and it gets published in the papers and everything comes down to test scores. How inappropriate. How many Americans know that the test scores are a class issue? That the upper class schools in this country, the top third, are the number one in the world. We are number one in the world in the top third. Our suburban schools, our wealthy schools, we're doing wonderfully. Our poor schools are like developing countries. They are scoring at the bottom. We may average in the middle, but the average masks the differences, and we don't see the differences.
Well, is it the scores that are the trouble or what we're doing with the scores?
Well, that's the first of all, understanding the scores are one, and then I think your point is excellent. I don't consider test scores in education. I don't think artists particularly get tested. I don't think how we treat each other gets tested. I don't believe how we deal with the rest of the world is on the tests. I think there are more enduring lessons. How we look at ourselves, how we treat each other as a culture, as a family, even how we treat strangers. Are we doing something worthwhile in our life? School should be, I think it was Horace Mann at the Antioch commencement services 150 years ago who said no one should look at their life with satisfaction who hasn't done some service for mankind. I think we ought to be training students and people to feel that community obligation to do something positive. And the last thing I care about is whether someone could do a quadratic equation on a test. I mean, that is one area for some students, but it shouldn't be the measure of all students.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. A fascinating program. I have one question. This notion that scientists or engineers are somehow born or innate, this idea that you could spot these scientific traits in students or that there's kind of a way to be a scientist. I'm wondering if what your impression is, if scientists or engineers are made or if they're born, especially looking at the university and the nationwide trends that we have with like 16% females in engineering. Is that just nature?
Oh, unless nature varies from culture to culture, no, because there are some cultures where females dominate computer science and math. It's our culture, which I think does a particularly poor job with females. If you look at many universities, including this one, I'm always amazed at how many women engineers are from other countries. Last night I spoke to a group. There were eight women engineers there in the program here, and seven were from other countries. So I don't think it's the biology. That may certainly play a role with individuals, but I think we can do a wonderful job of a much better job of pulling in women into engineering and science. And the whole nation will benefit from that because they bring a culture and insights that are otherwise being lost. I used to say that in Failing at Fairness, I said, if the cure for cancer is in the mind of a female, we may never get it. How many inventions and insights are in the minds of a female who is not becoming the engineer or the scientist? That's the cost of sexism.
And if I could ask one follow-up question.
Sure.
As to what you see the role of the adults in the learning environment to be in all of this, in creating scientists or facilitating students into being engineers, into their potential with math and science. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Yeah, great question. We're all a community, and parents are critical. Research shows that they're critical for both boys and girls, but both parents being committed to a career in science may be the most critical thing a girl could have. A mother who role models, strong science and math interest, is showing a female, a girl, a role model. The father who supports that is saying to the girl, in a sense, you are still attractive and loved and wanted by the other gender, even though you're pursuing a non-traditional career. So the support of both the father and the mother are very important for females looking in non-traditional careers.
Another question involving parents. A couple of times a year, parents are going to, I hope at least a couple of times a year, get together with the teachers that their children are in school with. What do you think should happen in that interaction, in that conversation? You know, it's not going to take, it won't be very long, but it seems to me that there might be some things that, you know, getting back to this idea of, you know, glass, you know, we can't see the forest from the trees. What kinds of things might parents think about that they might want to talk about constructively with the teachers?
Well, I think they want to talk about their goals for their child, how their child is doing in school, how well the teacher knows their child. Does the teacher have to look in books and look up grades, or does the teacher know off the top of her head or his head what that child is like? Monitoring student progress is a sign that the teacher is really on top of the situation. I think if you pick up sexism from your teacher, sex stereotyping, words, you have to pursue that and see if the school district is providing training for teachers to be non-sexist. And I'll give you one quick personal story on that. My older daughter was in sixth grade, and she took a math test, which places her in middle school math level. She did not well on it. She was in the second group instead of what Myra and I thought she should be in, the first group. And we called for a meeting, and we asked what happened, and they said that was how she scored. Then we did something parents too infrequently do. We asked to see the test. So they pulled out the test, and right in the middle of the test was a note from the nurse that Robin wasn't feeling well, and she left the test, and she was resting in the nurse's office, and only half the test was done. Had we not gone, and they ended up placing her in the first math group, had we not asked for the test, she would not have been going on in math. Today, Robin is a physician, and I often say that day was one of the barriers that made her a physician.
Yeah. I can remember taking a really important test and wanting to do so well on it, and what I did was I spent too much time on one part of it. I had no idea when time was going to be called. So there's all kinds of things that can enter into how you take a test.
Time hurts girls, time tests, and multiple choice. Guys are much more likely to guess, and girls less likely.
Yeah, don't leave those spaces
Fill
blank.
Them all in fast.
I had a teacher who called that intellectual bingo. Dr. Sadker, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. David Sadker is a professor of education at American University. He's in Champaign-Urbana at the University of Illinois today for the Illinois Symposium on Gender in the Pre-College Science, Mathematics, and Technology Classroom. And there's one more session that you can catch Dr. Sadker's in this afternoon from 3:15 to 4:30 this afternoon in the lower level of the ACES Library on the U of I campus, 1101 South Goodwin in Urbana. And I'm told listeners are welcome to attend the closing session. Again, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Let's check in very quickly with Jack Brighton in Pledge Central. Jack, where do we stand?
We stand at $128,103. That's the number of dollars raised so far this week. We're doing very, very well, and the total is rising rapidly. But let's keep in mind that we've got a long way to go on our way to $160,000 for the week and only a day left in the drive. So really, it's an uphill battle, as it always is, it seems, in public broadcasting. We count on your support, so please make that pledge call right now, 217-244-9455. You know, we've given you all kinds of reasons to support the station, and I think you already knew that it was very important and that everyone has a role to play. So right now, this is the time, just get it done.
Yeah.
Make that pledge call,
yeah.
217-244-9455.
It's been on your to-do list all week. Now's the time to do it. 217-244-9455. Basic membership $40 a year. That's just pennies a week. 217-244-9455. The volunteers are in Pledge Central. They're waiting to take your telephone call. Be the next to call. We accept Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express. 217-244-9455. And to those of you who have joined us, either as new friends or renewing your membership this week, thank you very much. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, and settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade.
Indeed they are, Celeste, from the Chicago Board of Trade. The settlements look like this. I'm Todd Gleason, and we'll be into the closing market report at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock this afternoon in just a few minutes. And we'll talk with Mike Zuzulo of Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Chalmers, Indiana, about all the happenings at the board. The beans finished the day 20 higher in the nearbys, and we'll talk a little bit about that. May futures in the wheat pit, let's begin there, where things finished the day lower. Contract had a high today of 375, a low at 369 and a quarter. May wheat settled at 373. It was down 6 cents on the day. July futures, 384 and a half the high. Low at 378 and a quarter. Settlement price at 382 and three quarters, down 4 and a quarter. September contract, 390 the high. The low at 385. Settlement price at 386, down 8 and a quarter. And December futures, 399 the high. The low at 393. Settled 397 and a half, down 5 and a quarter. Contract for the March, 403 the high, the low at 398. Settlement price at 403 there, down 3 and a half cents in the March 05 wheat. May corn pit now 305 and a quarter, high low at 301 and a quarter. Settlement price in the corn pit at 303 and a half in the May contract, down 1 half cent for the day. July futures 311 and a half on the high, the low at 307. Settlement price 309 and three quarters unchanged. In September futures up a quarter cent, 309 and a quarter the high, the low at 304. Settlement price at 307 and a quarter for the day. December contract a penny higher, 307 and a half the high, the low at 301 and three quarters. Settled 305 and a half. Once again, your new crop December up 1 cent. March futures a penny higher, 310 and a quarter the high, the low at 305, settled 308 and a quarter. And the May futures were up a penny too, 312 and a quarter the high, the low at 307 and a half. Settlement price there at 310 and a quarter. July contract in the corn pit for 05, 312 the high, the low at 307, settled 310 and a quarter. And they finished the day 1 cent higher. December futures up a quarter of a cent for the 2005 year, 276 and a half the high, the low at 275. A settlement price once again on that 2 year contract out 276. Settlement for the December up a quarter of a cent. May oats now 164 and a half the high, the low at 162. Settled 163 and a half, and they finished 3 and a quarter higher. July futures 171 and a quarter high, low at 168 and a half, and July oats settled 170. They were up 3 3/4 cents. Most of the action taking place in the bean pit, while the corn futures sat on the sideline and just sort of waddled around a bit. May futures in the bean pit up 20 cents, and this one's kind of important, I think, on the cash price in South America. So apparently that crop is fairly short, or at least they're having a tough time getting it through the fields. May contract, 968 and a quarter the high. Low at 950 and a half. A settlement price at 967. They were up 20 for the day. July soybeans, 963 the high. The low at 942 and a quarter. Settlement price, 961, up 21. And August beans, 906 the high, the low at 890, settled 905 and a half, up 19 and a quarter cents. September futures, this is as close to the new crop as you can get without being there, 795 the high, the low at 783 and a half, settled 794 and a half, up 9 and a quarter. And now your new crop November, 740 the high, the low at 730 and a half, settled 739 and three quarters, up 5 and a quarter. January contract, 741 the high, the low at 732, settled 740 and a half, a nickel higher for the day. In the March soybean, 733 and a half the high, the low at 727. They settled 733 and a half, up 2 and a half cents. The May bean meal for the day, 303.80 the high, the low at 298.60. The settlement price at 303.40. They were up 4.30 in July meal. 302 the high, the low at 296. The settlement price at 301.50, up 480 for the day. May bean oil, 33.19 the high, the low at 32.22, settled 33.01. They finished the day up 114. And July bean oil, 32.85 the high, the low at 31.85, settled 32.68, up 124 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. Higher day today on the Merc. Livestock futures finished higher across the across the whole thing here. April feeder cattle, today's high 94.95, the low 94.77.5, the settlement 94.90, that up 27.5. May 93.17.5, the high 91.80, the low 92.82.5, the settlement that up 87.5. August 94.95, the high 93.75, the low 94.60, the settlement that up 97.5. April live cattle 82.85, the high 82.12.5, the settlement 82.82.5, the final price that up 82.5. June 76.50, the high 75.70, the low 76.47.5, the settlement that up 80. August 78.80, the high 77.80, the low 78.65, the settlement that up 60. October 79.45, the high 79.05, the low 79.35, the settlement that up 42.5. May lean hogs 71.35, the high 70.55, the low 71.30, the settlement that up 57.5. June lean hogs 72.10, the high 71.20, the low 71.72.5, the settlement that up 2.5. July 72.10, the high 71.30, the low 72 even, the settlement that up 60. August lean hog 69.80, the high 68.80, the low 69.65, the settlement that up 55. May pork bellies 107.50, today's high, the low 105.80, the settlement 107, that up 47.5. Now let's take a look at the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It's up 17 points at 10,478. The NASDAQ is 13 higher at 2046. The S&P 500 is up 1 point at 1141.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Ellen Wollishin from Ontario, Canada writes, Dear Dr. Science, if you get the first monopoly early enough in the game, you usually win no matter which properties you get. However, if by that time it's late enough so that the other players can also get monopolies, then the advantage disappears. Do you have a particular monopoly plan of action?
Go for the orange properties. They're cheaper. They get landed on the most because of their proximity to jail. Boardwalk and Park Place are just for status. They make little practical sense. If you were playing Monopoly with Donald Trump, well, he'd buy them, go bankrupt, and then start whining for a government bailout. Now, my personal strategy is to declare a revolution, confiscate all private properties, jail their owners, and then have myself elected heroic leader of the people and savior of the nation. Works every time, though the game gets kind of ugly. You can't win at Monopoly and worry about being a nice guy.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Visit Dr. Science on the web at www.drscience.com.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano show.